recognizable here in New York. What is somewhat less well known is the fact that the Hasidic communities have a unique and distinctive way of thinking, worldview on life, set of principles, which was always intended to really become the property of the entire Jewish nation. And so, personally, I was very inspired by my exposure to this style of thinking, even though I didn't grow up with it. I went to Yeshiva University, not at all a Hasidic institution, but I was very attracted to the world of Hasidic thought. I've had the privilege of studying a little bit of it. I published a book about it. And it's really a great privilege to come here and to share some of these ideas with all of us, so that hopefully everyone here will enjoy it at least as much as I do, and maybe much more. So first, a little bit of history. What is the Hasidic movement? And what exactly is unique about Hasidic thought? For that, we really need to go back to understanding, and I apologize if any of this is repetitive to what you'll hear with Rabbi Wilds, or what other classes have covered, but we need to understand a little bit about the Jewish library. When you look behind you, you see all these books. What are all these books? Where do they come from? And when were they written? Well, Jewish knowledge, the key date where Jewish knowledge begins, is the year, the Hebraic year, the Jewish year of 2448. We're now in the year 5770 in the Jewish calendar. In the year 2448, the Jewish people leave Egypt, and 49 days after exiting Egypt, arrive at the base of a mountain in the desert, the Sinai Mountain, and merit to get a revelation of God. Millions of people, because the Torah talks of 600,000 men over the age of 20. They were all married, so you're already up to 1.2 million. And they all had at least one child, because they die and their children end up entering the land of Israel, so we're up to at least 1.8 million, and then there are probably more than one child in a family. So we're talking about millions of people who come to the foot of Sinai. And on the 6th of Sivan, in the year 2448, which is approximately, I did some rough math, I think 1213 before Common Era, roughly. I may be way off, but I think that's what it is. It's some 3,322 years ago. The Jewish people are at the foot of Mount Sinai, and God talks to the entire Jewish nation. God says, I am God, your Lord, who took you out of Egypt. God says, do not have any other molten images, statues before me. Don't worship idols. And to hear God speak is overwhelming. People just can't stand that. Their souls jump out of them and they fall down dead and they have to be revived. And it's pretty scary to die, be revived, and then die again and be revived. So the Jewish nation turns to Moses and they say, Moses, we don't want to do this anymore. You talk to God and tell us what God says. So Moses says, I'll ask God. He asks the Almighty, and God said, that's fine with me. I'll talk to you, and you then tell the Jewish people. Moses goes up to the top of the mountain, disappears in a cloud, and spends 40 days in heaven receiving instruction from God. Then, as we know, he comes down after 40 days. The Jewish people are worshiping a golden calf. Here we just heard God himself say two things. I am God and do not have any other gods before me. We're worshiping a golden calf. Moses breaks the tablets. The Jewish people go through a whole repentance process. And eventually Moses goes back, gets another set of tablets, comes down, and starts to tell the Jewish people about building the tabernacle, and continually teaches the Jewish people the message of God. So the key moment, or where Jewish knowledge begins, is when Moses goes up to the mountain, because that's when God is teaching Moses the Torah. What exactly did God teach to Moses? So he taught him a bunch of things. He clearly told him this book that's on every table, the five books of Moses, the Torah. He conveyed that to Moses. Throughout the book, we'll have the sentence, and God said to Moses, tell everyone, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'mor. God told Moses, tell everyone. The whole book was dictated by God to Moses. So clearly, a lot of the information in the book was given to Moses in the year 2448. The stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and the creation narrative, and the flood narrative, all of that was told to Moses when he's up at Sinai. But Moses got a lot more. Because a good way of understanding the Torah is to think of it as the notes of a speech. God willing, we'll learn together for 45 minutes. But this is the extent of my notes. I have about 7 lines here. That's the Torah. The Torah is the notes. There was a whole speech. The notes are just to remember the speech. The speech is really the corpus of information that God gave to Moses. The Torah is just to remember that information. And there are tremendous amounts of laws that are not written in the Torah, but were told to Moses. The Torah has reminders about these laws, and Moses then conveyed them to the Jewish nation. Just as an example, Moses says in the Torah, that God said, on the Sabbath, do not do any work. Lo taseh kol melacha. Do not do work on the Sabbath. But nowhere in the five books is there a definition of what work is. The Torah never says what is work. And yet, in the book of Numbers, the Torah tells us a story that there was a person who was mekoshei sheitzim, doing something with wood, unclear of what. Maybe he was lighting a fire with wood, maybe he was carrying wood, doing something with the wood, and the people bring this person to Moses, they say he's violating the Sabbath. How do they know? The Torah never said anything about wood in the Sabbath. But that's just an example. The Torah is the notes of the lecture. But there was a whole lecture. The lecture was where Moses came down. When Moses said, keep the Sabbath, he then explained what the Sabbath was. 39 primary categories of work. Each one of these 39 primary categories has another 39 derivative categories. And then he spoke about all sorts of fences to stay away from violating the laws. None of that was written in the text. That was oral. But the text contains hints to that. And that is Jewish law. Jewish law has an enormous amount of law that was given to Moses orally, was not recorded in the text of the five scrolls. But the text of the five scrolls, within its verses, there are all sorts of hints to remind the reader of the laws, because the laws were given together with the text. So with the text, there were reminders to the law so that the reader of the laws, the speaker of the speech, would, as it were, know and remember the speech that he is to give. Moses received a lot of law at Sinai. Yeah, Simone was the name?
Yeah,
okay.
We cannot come in short.
Please, more questions the better.
The five books, is that something that whoever wrote the Torah wrote that whoever wrote the Torah made up, like
to divide it into five books?
Yeah.
That was also dictated by God to Moshe at the end of Moshe's life. The last day of Moses' life, the 7th of Adar, this is the year 2488. On the 7th of Adar, in the year 2488, God tells Moses, now it's time to put the Torah into its final form. Here I'm going to dictate it to you, and you write it down. Moses writes it down. He wrote 13 copies of it, gave one copy to each one of the 12 tribes, another copy to be deposited in the temple as the master text of the Torah, and Moses died on that day, the 7th of Adar, 2488. Irina?
Yes.
Okay,
yes. Yeah. This is a question about the 12 tribes.
Yes.
At that point, were they living as almost as separate nations?
Almost, yes. They lived in the desert, each in their own encampment. And to some degree, they were separate, but on the other hand, they were also together. Once they entered the land of Israel, each one gets its own area within Israel. They had their own courts. And, you know, the system of law was that if there was a question within, let's say, the tribe of Reuven, it would go up to the Supreme Court within Reuven. If they didn't know the answer, they would go to the Supreme Court, which was in the temple.
So did they intermarry among themselves?
Initially not. initially, not always, but after the first once they entered the land of Israel and they had one generation in the land of Israel, all the tribes were allowed to intermarry with each other. So Moses writes the scroll at the end of his life. The scroll is one thing that we have from Moses. The laws, the oral Torah, the oral tradition, comes from Moses. But in addition to law, God conveyed to Moses a lot of other information. To give you an example, there is traditions, not only of law, but about character, about relationships, about personal practice, traditions about anger versus patience, traditions about honesty versus white lies, traditions about humility versus confidence, arrogance versus cockiness. And that was also given to Moses. And that's also found, hints to it are found within the text. But that's a tradition that was given to Moses. In addition to those traditions, secrets of how to achieve prophecy were given to Moses. Prophecy wasn't a person just walking down the street and suddenly becoming a prophet. It was a tradition. It was a whole discipline of a person working on himself or herself to become a prophet, to reach a point where the soul could transcend the body and attach itself to God, get a vision of some point of the future, hear a message from God, and then come back and convey that message to people. The prophets were individuals who studied the discipline of how to become prophets and then became prophets and shared messages of prophecy with the Jewish people throughout our history till the destruction of the first temple. To review again our history, in the year 2448 on the Jewish calendar, we left Egypt. In the year 2488, we enter into the land of Israel. When we enter into the land of Israel, we live in the land of Israel for 480 years. After 480 years, the first temple is consecrated. It's inaugurated by Solomon. The first temple stands for 410 years. So we have a process here of 990 years. Over this span of time, 990 years, when the Jews entered Israel, till the first exile, the times of Nebuchadnezzar, first exile, the exile of Babylon, the leadership of the Jewish people are not only sages, they're not only priests, they're prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Samuel, Saul, David, these are all prophets who communicate with God and who come and give the Jewish people messages. Sometimes the messages are very harsh. Isaiah might say, God is telling you, I don't want you to walk into my temple, trample my courtyard with your offerings of animals when you're neglecting to take care of the orphan, the widow, the poor person at the edge of the community. Sometimes the prophecies are messages that are very hopeful. The prophet Ezekiel might describe to the Jewish nation what a final redemption will look like, a magnificent temple which will be triple the size of what they know of. And they're describing messianic ages, famous messianic visions. The wolf will live with the lamb, the lion with the deer. These are prophecies that the prophets described and talked and taught to the Jewish people, gave messages to the Jewish people. There's a whole discipline how to achieve prophecy. We have books that tell us how to achieve prophecy. We have books, but they're not exactly the full story. What we have are books of mysticism, books that are known as books of Kabbalah, or Kabbalah. The books of mysticism are the derivatives of the tradition of how to achieve prophecy. When Moses was at Sinai, God gave Moses the text of the five books of Moses. God gave Moses laws, many laws. What is keeping Shabbat? How does a person keep Shabbat? What is violating Shabbat? What is kosher? What isn't kosher? All of the laws were given to Moses. But in addition to law, in addition to ways of interpreting the text, God also gave Moses a whole discipline of how to achieve prophecy. That discipline was used to create prophets over the course of almost 1,000 years that we lived in Israel until we were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar and the destruction of the first temple, and we lost the first temple and we were exiled to Babylonia. The discipline of prophecy starts to dissipate at that point. It starts to disappear. One of the prophets of that time was the prophet Ezekiel that I mentioned, the prophet Yechezkel. Yechezkel Navi begins his book by saying that he's outside of Israel. He's in Babylonia. He's next to the river Kvar in a displaced person's internment camp. And he begins the book by saying, "There I was, on the banks of the river, far from Israel, far from Jerusalem, when one night the heavens opened and I saw the visions of God. I saw a stormy cloud and an ever-igniting fire. I saw a curtain of clouds, stormy wind, an ever-igniting fire, a curtain of clouds. I saw a glow. And then I saw wheel angels and fire angels and God's chariot above all of it, and the Almighty riding on His chariot." The prophet Ezekiel, the very beginning of his book, it's called Ma'aseh Merkava, the story of God's chariot, is really describing in those 48 or 50 verses the secrets of the whole discipline of how to become a prophet. But it's couched in allegory, in mystery, in hints. Nothing's explicit. But the discipline of how to achieve prophecy is there. And that's really at the end of the period of prophecy. To give you another example of this dynamic throughout our history, I mentioned that just as there was a discipline of how to achieve prophecy, there is a long tradition of law, a very large corpus of law. There's a lot of type of Jewish law. You have laws that God told to Moses at Sinai. There are laws that are derived from the text using the tools of biblical interpretation. And then there's rabbinic law. Sometimes a group, a high court of the Jewish nation will legislate a law, and that will become new law, and that becomes added to the corpus of laws. So think, just as in the United States, you have a constitution, and then Congress can pass laws based on the constitution and add new laws. The Torah is our constitution. Sometimes the Sanhedrin, the high court, functioning as the legislators of the land, would create new law. So you look in the corpus of law, there's an enormous amount of books of law. Tremendous. The Talmud, 36 tractates of Talmud, 63 tractates of Mishnah, books like Maimonides, the Code of Jewish Law, Poskim, thousands and thousands of books of Jewish law. Originally, none of those books could be printed, because the law originally stated that the oral tradition had to stay oral. And so the oral tradition was completely oral. All the laws were completely oral. Nothing was written down. Moses wrote the five books, but he did not write anywhere what the 39 prohibited categories of work on the Shabbat were. He hinted to them in the five books, but he didn't spell it out, because that was oral tradition. Oral tradition was not allowed to be written down until the Second Temple was destroyed. The Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era, or 70 AD. After the Second Temple was destroyed, there were many Jewish revolts against Rome, before and after the Temple was destroyed. Those revolts led to devastating consequences to the Jewish people. The Jews were killed, almost wiped out again and again and again. One of those revolts was the Bar Kokhba revolt that began around the year 123 of the Common Era. some 50-some years after the destruction, 122, 123 of the Common Era, and 50 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. The rabbis endorsed Bar Kokhba's revolt. The Romans were livid. The Roman Emperor Hadrian was extremely upset. And Hadrian decided to go out on a campaign against the rabbis and against the study of Torah. He prohibited the public teaching of Torah. He prohibited the ordination of rabbis. He prohibited the private study of Torah on pain of death. Rabbis were being killed. The Jewish nation was being persecuted. And there was a terrible, terrible danger that great amounts of law would be forgotten. And so a great sage, Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, decided to take it on his shoulders to break with precedent and to fulfill a verse in Psalms. It's time to do for your sake, O God, violate your Torah. That sometimes for the sake of maintaining the tradition, it's necessary to sacrifice or to violate an aspect of the tradition, because the whole tradition might be lost. And so to maintain the tradition, Rabbi Judah the Prince started to write down the law, and that's the Mishnah. The Mishnah was composed around the year 200 of the Common Era by Rabbi Judah the Prince, 63 tractates dealing with laws ranging from agricultural law, leaving a corner of the field to the poor, leaving gleanings to the poor, not to plant together wheat with grapes, ranging from agricultural law all the way to the most intimate personal laws of ritual purity, tractate Nida, and it's a summary of a lot of law. And from there, there's been many, many books written to further flesh out the law, further deal with new cases, and apply the law to the new cases. Why was the law written? Because the law otherwise might have been lost. It might have been forgotten. Same is true with prophecy. At the end of the prophetic era, time of Ezekiel, prophecy is coming to an end. The last prophets are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. They die at the very beginning of the Second Temple era. So Ezekiel, who's at the end of the First Temple era, who's already been exiled, who's already outside of Israel, and the exile between the First and Second Temple is 70 years, Ezekiel has a vision of prophecy. And what that vision is really how to become a prophet. What's the process that the prophet goes through? What does he have to go through to eventually achieve communion and attachment with God? He writes it down, but it's extremely opaque and extremely hidden. Let's go further. 70 years after Ezekiel, it's a little more, it's about 80 years because Ezekiel left Israel before the first temple was actually destroyed. But again, 70 years after the destruction of the first temple, second temple is built. There are three last prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and they pass away. Prophecy ends. There's no prophecy. You have the second temple. It stands for 420 years. As I mentioned, in the year 70 now of the Common Era, the second temple is destroyed in the aftermath of one of the Jewish revolts. It's destroyed by the Romans, led by their general Titus, who eventually becomes an emperor in Rome. 52 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, there is the Bar Kokhba revolt. Bar Kokhba is a charismatic, general, brave, gallant, courageous. In the legends, it said that a stone could be catapulted into a city. Bar Kokhba would catch it with his bare hands and throw it back at the Romans. This very strong, dashing man declares himself king of the Jews. The Jews are independent of Rome, and they revolt. And as we know, the Romans didn't take nicely to the revolt. They come, and after 2.5 years of fighting Bar Kokhba, they destroy him, decimate him. Where were the rabbis in this discussion? The leading rabbi of the time was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was an enthusiastic supporter of Bar Kokhba. More than that, Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba might even be the Redeemer. He might be Mashiach. He might be the Messiah that the prophet Isaiah talks about. He's the Messiah that the prophet Zechariah spoke about. He is the one who will redeem Israel. And then Bar Kokhba dies, and Rabbi Akiva clearly recants, says, I made a mistake, didn't work out, Bar Kokhba is not the Redeemer. The Romans are extremely tyrannical. They come, start killing rabbis. There's a danger that the law will be forgotten. The same way there's a danger that the law will be forgotten, there's a danger that the traditions of how to achieve prophecy that were preserved somewhat by Ezekiel in the beginning of his book are also going to be forgotten. And so there's a student of Rabbi Akiva whose name is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Talmud says, was a man who was extremely straightforward, extremely honest, and wasn't at all concerned about the Romans. The Talmud has the following story. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Lai, and Rabbi Yossi were sitting in northern Israel in the Galilee, city of Tzipori. And there was a fellow by the name of Yehuda, son of Gerim, who was listening. And they were talking about Rome. Rabbi Yehuda, son of Elai, said, the Romans are great. They came to Israel. They built aqueducts. You can go to Caesarea. You can see their aqueduct. They built bridges. They built roads. Life is wonderful. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, the Romans are terrible. They built aqueducts to tax our water. They built bridges to take tolls. They built highways so that they could bring prostitutes here. They're terrible. The Romans, they didn't do anything for us. They're terrible, terrible people. We should have nothing to do with them. And Rabbi Yossi was quiet. Yehuda ben Gerim goes home, tells his wife about this conversation of the three rabbis. Before they know it, the Roman governor hears, and the Romans decide Rabbi Yehuda, who praised the Romans, should be made into the prince of the Jews. Rabbi Yossi, who was quiet, should be banished. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was critical, should be killed. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai goes into hiding, initially in a house of study. Eventually he goes into a cave near the city of Meron. He goes into a cave, submerges himself and his son, Rabbi Elazar, in dirt, because they don't know how long they're going to be in the cave. If they wear the clothing will wear out. Eventually it'll be torn, it'll be threads. So they take off their clothing, they immerse themselves in the dirt, and this way their bodies are covered, and when their bodies are covered, they feel that they can study Torah. And they study. They study the written Torah. They study the oral Torah. They study the traditions of prophecy. They study the Kabbalah. They study the secret mystical traditions that go all the way back to Moses. The same way the law goes all the way back to Moses, the mystical prophetic traditions go back to Moses. And they study it in the cave. And when in the cave, they have out-of-body experiences. They feel that the soul of Elijah the prophet comes and talks to them. The soul of Moses comes and reveals to them new levels of understanding. They spend 12 years in the cave. They come out of the cave. They go back into the cave. They end up spending 13 years in the cave. And after 13 years, they hear a voice from heaven. They get a premonition. It's time to come out. You can come out. The Romans won't chase you. They come out. And they settle in Israel. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son taught these traditions that they had really delved into while in the cave to a group of students. These students took the traditions and wrote them down in notes. And they taught them to students, who taught them to students. And so there was a whole tradition that wasn't taught in the houses of study, usually, but to people who were very pious, ascetics, individuals who were all concerned with soul and not really concerned much about body. These were people who would be brought aside by a sage and who would say, listen, come, I'm going to teach you some of the secrets. I'm going to teach you some of the deep traditions that go back to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We really go back to the story of Ezekiel. It really goes back all the way to Moses. Secrets of mysticism, secrets of philosophy, theosophy, secrets of how God runs the world, how God made the world, how God can be reached and communicated with. And it stays this way until the 13th century. In the 13th century in Spain, there's a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Moses de Leon. Rabbi Moses de Leon takes these notes that he received from a teacher, and he starts to edit them, and he publishes them for the first time, and he calls it the Book of Zohar. Zohar literally means glow, emanation, radiance. The Book of Zohar is a three-volume book initially, as it was first published. And in this three-volume book, presented as a commentary to the Torah, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his students reveal through discussion, the same way the Talmud reveals through discussion laws, they reveal through discussions mystical laws or mystical truths, mystical ideas, mystical principles. The book is extremely difficult. If you pick it up and try to read it, it's all allegories. A 13-petaled rose surrounded by thorns. Careful that the thorns not puncture the petals. What does this all mean? It's hard to understand. But it's published in the 13th century. And this book is the core, or one of the major texts of the mystical tradition, the Kabbalah tradition, which is really the tradition that goes all the way back to Moses of how to achieve prophecy, how to attach with God. It's still a closed book. Not many people understand it. To understand it, you really have to be taught it by someone who was taught by someone who was taught by someone going all the way back to the Shimon bar Yochai. But there are schools of rabbis who are studying it, who are explaining it, who are defining it. And that brings us to the 16th century. As we know, in the year 1492, the government of Spain decided to expel all the Jews who had been living in Spain. Jews were not allowed to live in Spain anymore. The 9th of Av, 1492, the 10th of August, I think it was the 10th of August, the Jews were sent out of Spain. The Jews were thrown out of Spain. And that was devastating. It would be sort of the equivalent of the Jews of America being expelled from America. You think of the United States, what an amazing country, where Rahm Emanuel is the chief of staff. He's an Israeli Jew, the chief of staff of this White House, the person who's closest to the president. In Spain, the chief of staff of the King of Spain was a rabbi, Rabbi Yitzhak Abarbanel. And the Jews were expelled from Spain. Jews had lived in Spain for hundreds of years. Jews had banks. Jews had merchant firms, businesses. They were completely integrated into society. They were generals in the army. They were poets and writers and teachers. And the King of Spain, 1492, said, everybody out. You've lived here for hundreds of years. All you can take with you is one suitcase. Go. Otherwise, if you stay here, you have to become a Christian. If you don't become a Christian, we're burning you at the stake in an auto da fe. It was devastating. It was devastating for the Jewish community, devastating especially for the Sephardic Jewish community, because the Jews of Spain, the word Sfarad actually means Spain. The Jews of Spain were Sephardic Jews. Devastating, devastating experience. Where did the Jews go? They go all over. Some go to Turkey, some go to Italy. Some go to North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunis, Egypt. Some end up in Israel. Either from Turkey to Israel, through North Africa, to Egypt to Israel. Remnants of the Jews expelled from Spain end up in Israel. Now for these Jews, if we put ourselves in their shoes, they had just experienced a cataclysm. You know, it would be like the American Jewish community being expelled from America. It would be devastating. And they start searching and exploring. And the study of mysticism gains a revival. Suddenly this study is becoming very, very prominent, very popular. And in 1534, a man is born originally in Jerusalem, then he lives in Egypt. His name is Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. Rabbi Yitzhak Luria is a brilliant, brilliant man, studies very deeply, studies the writings of the Zohar, spends 7 years meditating about the Zohar, thinking about it, studying it, hardly eats, hardly sleeps, is praying all the time, is thinking about God all the time, and he develops a whole approach to explaining the Zohar and explaining really what the traditions of Kabbalah are. He goes, he moves to Israel, moves to Tzfat in northern Israel. Why Tzfat? Because it's right near Meron. Tzfat is about, I think, 5 kilometers from Meron. Meron, remember, is where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was in the cave. That's where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai composed the ideas of the Zohar. That's where he further fleshed them out. He lives near there, and the Ari gathers around him a group of students, and he inspires them. And our Judaism is so influenced by the Ari. I'll give you an example. Friday night. In Jewish communities all over the world, Friday night, after the afternoon service, there's Kabbalat Shabbat. What's Kabbalat Shabbat? 7 chapters of Psalms. Why 7 chapters? 1 for each day of the week. And in the middle of these 7 chapters, a song, L'cha Dodi. Who composed L'cha Dodi? Is L'cha Dodi an old prayer that goes back to the days of David? No. L'cha Dodi was composed in the 16th century by a student of the Ari HaKadosh, Rabbi Shlomo Alkibetz, who's living in Tzfat. Because the Ari HaKadosh in Tzfat used to go out into the orchards on Friday afternoon and say, let's get ready for the Shabbat. And the way to get ready for the Shabbat is to say a psalm for each day of the week. Each psalm is going to fix one of the days of the week. And to enter into Shabbat, let's sing a song, L'cha Dodi. And the song of L'cha Dodi is a Kabbalistic song. But this prayer, which was instituted by the rabbis of Tzfat in the 16th century, has spread throughout the Jewish world, from Europe to Africa to the Middle East. Jewish communities all over pray Kabbalat Shabbat. It comes from the Kabbalists. It comes from the Ari. The Ari died at the age of 38 in the year 1572. Had a tremendous impact. He didn't write anything himself. He wrote a couple of songs, poems. He didn't write any books, but he had a student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And a student of Chaim Vital composed, after a year and a half of studying with the Ari, composed from the notes of the Ari books, 8 volumes, explaining the Ari's ideas, called Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life. And that opened up the whole world of mysticism now to many, many people. Mysticism spreads from Israel to Europe, through Italy, to France, Germany, to Jews in Europe. And then, about 100 years after the Ari, there's a terrible tragedy that mysticism plays a great role in. And that's the tragedy of the false Messiah. In the year 1626, a young man is born in Smyrna, in the Ottoman Empire, Shabtai Tzvi. His father's name was Tzvi. He gets known as Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was a mystic, studied the writings of the Ari, and misused them. Based on the writings of the Ari HaKadosh, he claimed that he was obligated by God to perform sins. And doing these sins was actually the way to serve God. To eat non-kosher and recite a blessing, blessed are you God who permits the forbidden. To go and to pronounce God's ineffable name, the name that was never, ever, ever to be pronounced other than by the high priest in the temple, and even then, only one day a year on Yom Kippur, to pronounce that name because God told him to do so. Because he's the Messiah who has come to redeem the Jews. And then Unfortunately, eventually Shabtai Tzvi gets arrested by the Sultan. The Sultan doesn't take too kindly to the ideas that there's a Jewish Messiah. Tell Shabtai Tzvi, you need to convert to Islam, otherwise I'm going to kill you. Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam, and with him thousands of well-meaning, sincere, good, wonderful Jews from Poland, from Turkey, from Egypt, either convert to Islam or just give up completely on their Judaism. It was devastating. And so now you have a reaction against mysticism. Because here mysticism, this dynamic, exciting, spiritual ideas, got used, misused by this charlatan to such devastating effect. And so there is a reaction within the Jewish nation, especially in Europe, Poland, and in Russia, to relegate the study of mysticism again. Let the real scholars do that. That shouldn't be for the masses. The really pious, pious people, let them study mysticism. Let them study the Kabbalah. Let them study the tradition of how to achieve prophecy. It's not for everybody. People can misuse these ideas. They can corrupt them. And what happened was that there was actually a turn of 180 degrees. The community focused primarily on the study of law, study of knowing what to do, doing it right. But you have to remember that the period of time, the 18th century, most Jews didn't have the luxury of being able to study. Most Jews had to work. Jews were poor. Jews were impoverished. And so what happened is that there were many Jews whose connection to Judaism was very tenuous. The only important people were the great scholars, the masters of the law. They couldn't possibly become masters of the law because they were struggling to survive and just work. And there was a danger here. The danger was that when the winds of modernity would blow, these Jews, whose connection to Judaism was tenuous, would be swept away in that tide of modernity. And when the ghetto walls would be opened, they would just throw it all away, throw away the Talmud and the Bible, and become European humanistic citizens. And so, in White Russia, the early 18th century, there's a man whose name is Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. He's born in a town in the Ukraine called Okup. He lives most of his life in another town, I think it's in the Ukraine, called Mezhbuzh. From Mezhbuzh.
Yes.
So that's where the Baal Shem Tov lived. And the Baal Shem Tov starts a new movement. It's a movement that is built on the teachings of Rabbi Isaac Luria.
What year was it?
Well, the Baal Shem Tov died in the year 1760. He was born in probably 1698. We're not sure. He may have been born in 1680. We're not 100% sure. He died in 1760. We know the date he was born on. He was born on the 18th of Elul. We know when he passed away. He died on Shavuot in the year 1760. But he was an orphan, the Baal Shem Tov. Didn't have a father, didn't have a mother. Grew up by the kindness of strangers. Studied in the synagogues. Eventually got a job cleaning the books in the synagogue. When everybody left, turning out the lights, blowing out the candles, slept in the synagogue, and there he would study and meditate, walk out into the forest and just talk to God. God, I love you. I can never thank you enough for making me a Jew. It's the greatest thing in the world to be part of your people. And he was just talking Yiddish or Russian or Ukrainian to God. And he started to develop a whole new approach. And what the approach of the Baal Shem Tov was to take the lessons of Rabbi Isaac Luria, which, as we've learned, is really an explication of the Zohar. And the Zohar really is an explication of the traditions of Ezekiel, which is really the traditions from Moses. To take these ideas of mysticism and to spread them. To teach them to the masses. But to take them in a different direction. Maybe mysticism initially was the way to achieve prophecy. Maybe for Rabbi Isaac Luria, mysticism was the way to understand the secrets of the cosmos and how this world, this physical, natural world, came into being. For the Baal Shem Tov, take all of that and use that as allegory and symbolism to give a person guidance how to improve his life. Give a person, a Jew, inspiration and direction how to live a passionate life. Love every Jew. Baal Shem Tov taught, just as one example, that a simple Jew who's willing to give his life up for Judaism and Jewish pride and God is the most special, is the holiest, the most amazing. Raise the banner, the simple Jew. Give the simple Jew passion. Tell a person, even if one doesn't study and he's not a scholar, but if he cries when he prays, wow, that's so sweet, that's so amazing, that's so great, it's so wonderful. Because the Baal Shem Tov was like an inoculation before the winds of modernity were going to come. Let's remember our history. When Napoleon sweeps through Europe in the beginning of the 19th century, Napoleon didn't only smash the various empires. Napoleon brought the ideas of the French Revolution. Liberty, fraternity, egalitarianism, freedom for all, secular humanism. Suddenly Jews are allowed out of the ghettos. Jews can suddenly go to universities. Jews can join society. The winds of the modern world are going to come. The Baal Shem Tov's approach, mysticism, passion, of celebrating every simple Jew, lifting him up, encouraging Jews to love each other, to pray with passion, to take mystical ideas and use them as guideposts how to improve our lives and increase our passion, was the inoculation to keep Jews observant when the winds of modernity were going to come. Now it was, needless to say, I shouldn't say that, but it was an extremely controversial movement. When the Baal Shem Tov started in his own lifetime, it wasn't controversial. But in the lifetime of his students, and as the movement begins to spread, and Jews suddenly say, you know what? It's great to learn Torah. It's great to learn Talmud. It's great to learn codes. But I'm going to sit and learn Zohar for a couple of hours in the afternoon. Not just learning Talmud. And I'm going to pray, instead of praying for a half hour, I'm going to pray for 3 hours every day. And I'm going to get so excited about doing an act of kindness and not only excited about learning. There was a reaction. Maybe this is another Shabtai Tzvi movement. Maybe this movement is antinomian. In other words, maybe this movement gets so excited about the reasons for the laws that they neglect to do the laws. They get so excited. Passover, you know, Hanukkah's coming. Hanukkah's coming. So the Kabbalists and the Hasidim say, Hanukkah. It's the hidden light. On the first day of creation, God made a light. But then on the fourth day of creation, God made the sun. The light of the first day of creation is a mystical light that God hid it away. When I light the Hanukkah candles, that hidden light is suddenly revealed. Oh my God, it's so special. The hidden light is coming revealed in this world. They get so excited about the hidden light, they don't light the candles. They start talking about the hidden light, they don't light the candles. It was a feeling. You get so into the ideas and the passion and the mysticism, you don't do it. But it's about doing, ultimately. The passion is to inspire us to do. So there was a fear amongst the legalists and the halachists, and especially the Lithuanian Jews. This is another coming of Shabtai Tzvi. It's messianic, it's inspired, it's mystical, it's exciting, it's spiritual. But you know what? That's what Shabtai Tzvi was. And look what he did. He ended up becoming a Muslim. And thousands of Jews left Judaism. It's dangerous. There was a great, great rabbi, probably the greatest genius of his age, Rabbi Elijah of Vilna. He was born in 1720. He died in 1797. He opposed the Hasidic movement. He fought the Hasidic movement. And really, till World War II, there was a great split in European Jewry, between an observant European Jewry, between those Jews who decided to follow the disciplines of the Hasidim, the inspired, mystical, ecstatic approach to Judaism, and the Jews who were worried that mysticism and ecstasy and joy and passion could end up becoming neglect of the law, neglect of doing. World War II decimated, unfortunately, all the Jewish communities. And after the war, these divisions have certainly been tempered and been mitigated. That's a little bit of the history of the Hasidic movement. So when did the Hasidic movement start? It starts in the early 18th century. It starts with Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. It spreads like wildfire through Russia, Ukraine, Poland, eventually Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia. There's always an opposition to the Hasidic movement. But the Hasidic movement is a movement that takes the ideas of mysticism, translates them in a way that we can all learn from them. I hope I wasn't too abstract in some of these descriptions, but I'll end with this one story. There was an opponent of the Hasidic movement, great rabbi. His name was Rabbi Arya Leib Heller. He's the author of a book called Ketzot HaChoshen, very deep book of legal analysis. But once met one of the Hasidic rabbis, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichev, and said to him, I get it. What's so special about the Hasidic movement? Baal Shem Tov was a Kabbalist. So was Rabbi Isaac Luria. So was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What's so special? He said, I'll explain to you what the Hasidic movement is. There's a country that has a wonderful, wonderful king. And then their king dies. They're bereft of a ruler, and they need a king. People are depressed, and they're sad, and they're mourning, and they're crying, we don't have a king. And so then, they start to hear rumors, you know, there's another country, a nephew of the king. They're vague rumors. Some people appreciate it, okay, they're not upset anymore. They know that there is a replacement there. But most people are very, very upset. They don't have the king. So somebody has an idea. Let's go send messengers to check out the story. They send out messengers. The messengers come back. They say, he's it. He's the one. He's going to be our king. He's wonderful. He's a great leader. But a lot of people meet the messengers and they feel relieved. But the poor peasants, they don't have the time to listen to the messengers. If they did, they wouldn't understand why it's a relief. They're still depressed. They don't have a king. So the leaders of the country say, we'll go bring him. They go and they bring that person there. And they take him around the country and say, here he is. Here's the king. And everybody gets it. They see him. They say, here's the king. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichev told Rabbi Arya Leib Heller, that's what the Hasidic movement is. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, in a world after the temple, when experiences with spirituality are rare, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai reveals that there's a way to get there. There's a way to get experiences of spirituality. Very few people can appreciate the Zohar. Very few people can understand it. So then, there are messengers sent out, and the messengers come back, and they'll talk about the king. That's Rabbi Isaac Luria and his students. They've already met the king. They'll talk about the king. But not everyone really understands what they have to say. The Baal Shem Tov is the teacher of the peasants. He says, the king is right here with you. I'm showing him to you. Open up your eyes. You'll see him. I'm taking these ideas and I'm bringing them to a level that they are so practical that you can apply them right away into your daily life. These are ideas that can guide you into how to build and construct your personality. So, I'm sorry I always took time from Rabbi Wilds, but God willing, we'll get into the ideas themselves, and certainly I would love to have everybody in my home for Shabbaton in 2 weeks. And I brought a copy of the book that I published about Hasidic thoughts, so you're welcome.